From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Three 3,000 U.S. troops are headed to Kuwait, and witnesses say thousands of Turkish troops are pushing into northern Iraq. Today, a debate on U.S. plans to attack Baghdad. Also, a non-military victory for labor. The longest strike in recent history has been settled in Las Vegas. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi said today that Italy and Russia will send a joint message to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, urging him to respond to diplomatic efforts to end the crisis in the country. Prodi told a joint news conference in Rome with Russian President Boris Yeltsin, "I believe this appeal will not go unanswered." Meanwhile, the Dutch Prime Minister, Wim Kok, has said political and diplomatic efforts must continue to avoid a lethal use of military force against Iraq. Kok said he had told U.S. President Bill Clinton by telephone at the weekend that the Netherlands backed Washington's insistence that Iraq must destroy its weapons of mass destruction and grant access to U.N. inspectors. China is saying it's stepping up its opposition to the use of force against Iraq over its standoff with U.N. arms inspectors, saying military action could trigger more serious conflicts. Oman has agreed to station U.S. support planes on its territory for a possible strike against Iraq. This, according to a senior U.S. military official accompanying Defense Secretary William Cohen. He said the tankers were part of a package of 23 support aircraft, which the United States announced during Cohen's visit to Germany last week. French Foreign Minister Hubert Védrine is saying that chances are diminishing for a diplomatic settlement to the Iraq crisis, but Paris will keep searching for a peaceful solution. South Africa says it opposes military action against Iraq and urges the United States to find a diplomatic solution to the crisis. The South African Foreign Minister Alfred Nzo told reporters at a parliamentary briefing, "These bombs will not kill Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. They will kill innocent civilians." Meanwhile, Iraq is issuing an open invitation to foreign politicians to visit Baghdad and hear its side of the story in a row with the United Nations over weapons inspectors. The Speaker of Iraq's parliament, Sadoun Hamadi, also sent a separate invitation to eight British parliamentarians he said had rejected the use of force to settle the inspections row. The global invitation was aimed at briefing, quote, the parties and personalities on Iraq's position towards the current crisis, which was manufactured by the United States, this according to the news agency and a Ba'ath Party source. It said the visitors would also see firsthand the effect of more than 7 years of economic sanctions in Iraq and could discuss, quote, the dangers of the American threats of a new military aggression against Iraq and the negative repercussions and the shock to regional security. Meanwhile, the United States is denying it's beating the drums of war against Iraq. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan appealed for cool heads in the Persian Gulf crisis. A U.S. official said that William Cohen, the defense secretary on a tour in the Gulf, has won agreement from Oman to station U.S. support planes there. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright began the administration's final push for Senate approval of NATO expansion as President Clinton prepares to submit documents for expansion to the Senate for ratification. The Senate is expected to move in March to approve the addition of Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic to NATO. Albright warned senators not to complicate the effort with a delay in any second round of expansion. Peace activists around the country and the world are opposed to the NATO expansion effort. The NATO expansion must be approved by a two-thirds vote in the Senate. Government prosecutors have summoned Monica Lewinsky to appear before a federal grand jury Thursday, a significant escalation of the battle over Lewinsky's testimony now that immunity talks have broken down. President Clinton's lawyers filed a formal complaint in federal district court, apparently accusing the independent counsel, Kenneth Starr, of disclosing secret grand jury information about the president. And House Republicans have quietly begun to prepare for possible impeachment action as expectations grow that the independent counsel would be more likely to refer any presidential wrongdoing he discovered to Congress rather than to a criminal proceeding. And Vice President Gore was well aware that an April 1996 Democratic Party event at a Los Angeles Buddhist temple was designed to raise money for his party. This is the conclusion of a final draft of the report by Senate Republicans investigating campaign fundraising abuses in the last presidential campaign. The draft report, a copy of which was obtained by the Washington Post, opens with the assertion that in the 96 campaign, President Clinton, Gore, and their top aides conducted a well-coordinated and highly successful effort to, quote, violate the letter and spirit of existing federal campaign laws. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, we have news over the last few days that Turkey's military has sent thousands of commandos into northern Iraq. This is being denied by the Turkish government, but witnesses say about 7,000 commandos backed by armored vehicles, together with Kurdish guides and medical teams, crossed into Iraq at the Haber border point. We're going to talk about the significance in just a minute, but first let me say hello to Juan Gonzalez, my co-host today. Juan, it's nice to have you back in the studio.
Yes, Amy, good day on this sad week, unfortunately, when the masters of war, as Bob Dylan once called them, are at it again.
That's right. You know, it's strange. Things are working very quickly. You've returned recently from Cuba. Well, that sounds like ancient history at this point, where you were covering the Pope's visit, because now the drums are beating.
Yes, and it's going to be very interesting to see how the American people continue to react to the bombardment of press information or social conditioning that they're getting these days.
You know, yesterday on Democracy Now!, we played a brief excerpt from the ABC Sunday morning talk show this week with Sam and Cokey. That's a new name for it. Five commentators, all expressing the same point of view. It was just a question of whether U.S. Troops should attack by air or should ground troops be involved. There was no question of should this not happen. Last night, you were watching another
show. Yes, I was watching the McNeil-Lehr report, and the same thing, five regional reporters from around the country, several of whom I know very well, all basically espousing, everyone's angry that we didn't get rid of Saddam Hussein the last time. Only, I think, Mike Barnicle of the Boston Globe even possibly suggesting that there are human beings on the other side, or there will be human beings on the other side of this bombing campaign that is being threatened.
I'd like people to call us and let us know if you've seen anywhere on television any peace activists speaking about the problems of attacking Iraq. In just a few minutes, we're going to have a debate on that issue. But right now, we're joined in our Washington studio at Pacifica Station WPFW by Connie Zulan, who is director of the American Kurdish Information Network. And Connie Zulan, we wanted to get your reaction to this news that witnesses say, though the Turkish government is denying it, that thousands of Turkish commandos have moved into northern Iraq.
True. If the Turkish government wants to deny it, they should let the reporters to go to the border region. They have blocked the area from the reporters, and they're saying that they have not sent the soldiers and commandos, but they have, and the local sources, local Kurds, are reporting that they have crossed the border.
Is there any sense of what their mission or their purpose would be?
In 1991, when the Gulf War started, the president of Turkey at the time, Özal, wanted to send the troops in again. And at the time, he would justify the sending in the troops with the quote that when the spoils are divided, we should be ready for them as well. Today, there are two components of this incursion. One is to, in their words, to crush the Kurdish rebellion, the Turkish Kurds who are fighting the Turkish government. And two is to extend the kind of create a buffer zone, and in their words, to prevent the refugees from coming into Turkey.
Now, the history of Turkey and its relation to Kurds hasn't been a good one. I mean, we've seen the bombardment of northern Iraq now for a while with no international sanctions against Turkey for doing this, for violating UN security. Aren't there UN Security Council resolutions saying that this should not be done?
To my knowledge, it's the area is no-fly zone, not just for the Saddam's planes and forces. It's a no-fly zone for everybody. When it comes to Turkey, Turkey flies in at will. At one time, two American helicopters were shut down because Turkey at the time was also flying in, bombing the Kurds. So they have this double standard ongoing since the Gulf, ever since the Gulf War.
And in terms of the, isn't there a potential that if Turkey then does try to annex or absorb more territory, that it will be actually exacerbating the contradictions that it's already facing in terms of Kurdish self-determination?
That's exactly what the foreign minister, the spokesperson for the Iranian foreign ministry, said this morning, apparently in the wire reports, that Turkey will be getting into a quagmire. There are two schools in the Turkish military. One is to expand to crush the Kurds everywhere and anywhere, and the other is to allow some reforms and to negotiate with the Kurds. But unfortunately, as you pointed earlier in the program, the masters of war, the hawks, are right now the policymakers, and the result is the war, the organized crime that is unleashed on the people.
Do the Kurds feel like they have any ally here? I mean, during the Persian Gulf War, number one, in 1991, when the Kurds attempted to rise up right at the end of the bombing, the U.S. in the end did not support them, though it had come out afterwards that there was a major CIA operation in northern Iraq working with the Kurds, and ultimately Saddam Hussein just executed the people that the Kurds that were working with the CIA at the time, and the CIA apparently pulled out for a while. Now we understand they're back. Is there any sense that there is anyone there to support the Kurds?
You know, the Kurdish history with the U.S. government is really a sad chapter. In 1991, Voice of America editorials urged the Kurds to rise up against Saddam with the hopes that they would be supported. That was the understanding on their part. If the Voice of America says that, then America would support them. They rose, but they were not supported, and they were crushed mercilessly. In 1975, that happened with Henry Kissinger when he supported the fighting of the Kurdish rebels against Saddam, and again they were left in the dark, and he had to run away, come to America. Today, unfortunately, the Kurds have really no faith in the U.S. declarations or proclamations, and both the PUK and the KDP leader have gone on record telling the U.S. not to attack. Because they feel that they will lose even more. As far as I'm concerned, I oppose war per se, but I think the Kurdish situation is so bad that any change in the status quo may actually bring in something good for them.
Now, in terms of Turkey's relationship to the impending U.S. Attack, we've heard a lot about other Arab countries that have basically opted out and said we want no part of this. Of this possible strike. What has been the Turkish government's relationship to the U.S. This time around?
You know, Turkish press accounts vary on this. At first, when the Secretary of State Albright visited the region, but not Turkey, they raised hell. How come we're not being honored with this high-level visit? But then the Secretary of State placed a call to Prime Minister of Turkey from Tel Aviv in Israel. And then the chief of staff visited together with the Undersecretary of State Mark Grossman, Ankara, and then they felt they were, so to speak, assuaged and felt that they were being honored. Now, the if you read the Turkish press, they are saying that the we are not going to let it happen, but. There's a lot of activity in the base in the southeast Turkey, which will be the place where the bombers will take off. So on the surface, they're saying there isn't much going on, but the people of the city are saying there's a lot of activity in Jurlik. A lot of planes are landing, a lot of planes are taking off. So there's some activity there that is not in the press, unfortunately.
Our understanding at this point from a Reuters report that just came out is that Turkish troops have killed 6 Kurdish rebels for the loss of 1 soldier in fighting in southeast of Turkey overnight. And I assume with the huge concentration of Turkish troops on the border and possibly what witnesses are saying, thousands of commandos entering northern Iraq, these are not going to be the only casualties.
That's right. The problem is the Kurdish rebels are not a standing army. They are waging a guerrilla war. And the government of Turkey has blocked the whole region to the foreign reporters. There was a Reuters reporter, Aliza Markus, and she became a persona non grata because she was reporting the facts. So the war is going to go on, the ugly war is going to go on, and there will be a lot of casualties, but unfortunately there won't be reporters to report it.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Kani Zulan, director of the American Kurdish Information Network based in Washington, D.C., for updating us on the situation. And we'll keep people abreast of what's happening not only on the Turkish border with Iraq, but happening all over Iraq and the world when it comes to the proposed U.S. air attack on Iraq. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we continue our discussion of Iraq. Bombs away, that's the way an article in the Houston Chronicle put it. Many polls and most mainstream media suggest that the American people support President Clinton's calls for military action against Iraq. But there is a newspaper and radio ad campaign that has begun to promote a diplomatic solution to the Iraqi standoff.
Bomb Iraq? That would only play into Saddam Hussein's hands. We'd risk American lives, kill innocent civilians, inflame anti-American hatred in the Gulf region, and divide the United Nations. And for what? No one expects the bombs to destroy Saddam Hussein and his henchmen or drive them from office. No one believes bombs can eliminate his weapons of mass destruction. Even the Secretary of Defense says so. Instead of letting Saddam Hussein draw us into the trap of endless military engagement, we need to isolate him, stay with tough UN sanctions and continue humanitarian aid to the Iraqi people, negotiate a peaceful end to the crisis. Call the president. Tell him not to bomb.
Paid for by the Fourth Freedom Forum.
And that is an ad that is put out by the Fourth Freedom Forum. We'll find out what that is in just a moment. With Peace Action, the nation's largest grassroots peace organization, they say Saddam Hussein's apparent development and concealment of biological weapons are indeed cause for concern, but there's no indication of any immediate threat to Iraq's neighbors and no justification for the use of military force by the United States. We're joined right now by Gordon Clark, who's executive director of Peace Action in Washington, D.C. Tell us about the ad campaign, Gordon.
Well, this is both a newspaper ad and a radio ad campaign that's going to be happening across the country. One of our colleague organizations, the Fourth Freedom Forum, has already started placing ads similar to the radio ad that you just heard in the Washington Post, in the New York Times, in USA Today, and a number of other newspapers across the country. In addition, Peace Action, along with other peace groups, are sponsoring a nationwide day of actions tomorrow, Wednesday, February 11th, that are going on currently in 30 cities across the country and in 25 different college campuses.
It's interesting in the ad that you say that you feel that the sanctions should be continued. That will certainly divide a lot of people in the United States who are opposed to military action, even those who are for military action who are calling for an end to the UN sanctions.
Well, actually, the issue of sanctions is one that divides the peace community itself. I think there are some members who believe that it's a viable alternative, a nonviolent alternative to dropping bombs. I think there are a lot of other people in the peace community who feel that sanctions, particularly in this situation, has become just one more weapon of mass destruction and is the responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of people. The ad that you heard, is, as you noticed at the end, is actually produced by Fourth Freedom Forum. That was their position on the sanctions. That is not necessarily the position of Peace Action or other organizations.
And Fourth Freedom Forum is?
It is an anti-war, anti-nuclear foundation that was founded by Howard Brembeck, an international businessman, and it's in Goshen, Indiana.
Well, when we come back, we're going to have a debate on the issue of a U.S. strike against Iraq. We'll be talking to Gordon Clark, Executive Director of Peace Action, as well as the Washington head of the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and the war drums are beating. The U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen is denying that the U.S. is beating the drums of war against Iraq. Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations, is calling for cool heads. The French, which have been pushing for diplomacy, have had a French envoy in Baghdad say they see the window for diplomacy closing. We're now going to have a debate on the issue of a U.S. air attack on Iraq. We're joined by Gordon Clark, Executive Director of Peace Action, and Paula Dobriansky. She's head of the Washington Office of the Council on Foreign Relations, formerly in the National Security Council under Presidents Carter and Reagan. She worked in the Human Rights Division of the State Department and for the U.S. Information Agency. And we do welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Paula Dobriansky, I'd like to begin by asking you what you think of the president's policy so far, and of the possibility for of an air attack on Iraq.
Well, I think President Clinton has really tried to make and see if diplomacy could work in dealing with Iraq and Saddam Hussein's regime, and it's clear that all efforts thus far of trying to go the diplomatic route have been for naught. In fact, not only have our inspection team not gotten on the ground, but they haven't been able to do the work that's really critical and at hand in terms of monitoring Iraq's chemical and biological weapons production. I think the administration has also tried to work within the UN structure to do what is necessary in consulting with many allies and countries in the region. But again, this has just not worked. So I think that the administration really has no recourse but to move forward with military action. And there are those who have encouraged military action because it just seems plain simple that you cannot make the Saddam Hussein's regime budge by other means. Sanctions have not worked in producing results. Diplomacy has not worked.
What would an air attack accomplish?
Well, I think it would demonstrate a number of things. First of all, I think that the United States' credibility is on the line in trying to ensure that these weapons, biological and chemical weapons of mass destruction, are not being produced, and we are uncertain about the scope and the scale of what Iraq has at this time. We are able, and we have been able, to pinpoint certain locations, but there's a great deal of uncertainty. So you have several factors. First, our own credibility is on the line for not being able to ensure that this production has gone forward. Secondly, it has ramifications for others, not only in the region but across the globe, who are watching what the United States is doing in this case and in tandem with its allies, and particularly in such hot spots like that of Bosnia, where we've seen conflict occurring and a U.S. leadership can be undermined. Secondly, I'd also say that very significantly, by undertaking a massive and sustained, not a pinprick military operation, but a massive and sustained military strikes, that in this case, I think it can be said that we will undermine Saddam Hussein's power base. His military infrastructure certainly can be targeted. He will also be shown that there are consequences to defying the Security Council. And his military infrastructure and his economic infrastructure will certainly be diminished.
Gordon Clark of Peace Action, please respond.
Well, I would say initially I'm not sure what Ms. Dobrynsky means by credibility, and I would suggest it's an interesting definition when, in fact, virtually the entire world is either pleading, urging, or warning us not to go to war with Iraq. We are going without the support of the United Nations Security Council. Predictably, the only country which is gung-ho behind us is Great Britain. So, in fact, quite contrary to what Ms. Dobrynsky is saying, I think our credibility continues to be undermined. We think we're looking tough. The rest of the world sees us as a domineering and arrogant bully, which is basically pushing to get what it wants. In terms of what this will accomplish, I'm afraid that it won't accomplish any of the things that Ms. Dobrynsky is saying. In fact, I don't accomplish much of anything except killing thousands of innocent people who really have no control over what Saddam Hussein does. In terms of getting Saddam Hussein to comply with the United Nations inspections or actually even destroying his weapons of chemical and or his stores of chemical and biological weapons, whatever they might be, no one is under the illusion that this even a massive bombing raid will do that. Even Secretary of Defense Cohen is saying it will not achieve this. We know in the Gulf War, when we had 43 days of bombing, that we were only able to destroy about 10 to 15% of Saddam Hussein's military apparatus. And in fact, it was the UN inspectors that came in and destroyed the majority of his nuclear weapons capabilities at that time, his nuclear weapons capability. In addition to this not achieving what we suppose or hope that it would, either in terms of getting rid of his biological chemical weapons or getting rid of Saddam Hussein itself, this could also lead to a whole slew of potentially disastrous consequences on the Middle East peace process, regarding terrorism, regarding the actual use of biological and chemical weapons. We are now, unfortunately, in the position of provoking the possible use of biological and chemical weapons. So far from achieving any laudable goal, I'm afraid that this course of action is, in fact, going to produce just a whole range of potentially disastrous consequences, in addition to doing the one thing that we know it will do for sure, which is kill thousands of innocent people, something which really does not endear us to the Arab world or, in fact, the world community at large.
Ms. Dobrynsky, I'd like to ask about this issue of the lack of support. In the Persian Gulf War, obviously, there was a broad coalition of nations that backed and participated in that endeavor. This time, it does look like the United States and Great Britain will be alone. How do you react to that argument?
Well, I think there are a number of points that first have to be made. First, I think there's the broad point about what is provided by the UN. I think those who certainly support a use of force, in this case, believe the U.S. has the authority under existing UN resolutions to take the necessary steps, including military action, to protect our vital interests in the Gulf. And in any case, American policy, can always be continued to be crippled or affected by a misguided insistence on total unanimity. We saw during the time of the Gulf War when Saddam Hussein promoted and had aggressed on innocent people in Kuwait. There was nothing provoked. You had already a war conflict situation where Iraq took aggressive behavior and action against Kuwait. At that time, there was a coalition, that's true, but what's interesting to note is that there were those who interpreted that our ultimate action of going to war in the Gulf was supported by UN resolutions. Others argue that it was not. So the first point is I think it could be said that there are those who look at what the UN Security Council has said, and that those measures, in fact, do provide the broad basis in which we should be in a position to protect our interests. I do want to mention a very important point that's been raised in this discussion, and that is about the prospect of thousands of people being killed. I think you have to look at two considerations here. First of all, if these weapons of biological and chemical weapons of mass destruction are not prevented from the continuous stockpiling, people are already threatened, and not only in that region. not only in that region, but I think you could say that this poses a threat at large, because if Saddam does acquire the capability to deliver weapons of mass destruction, as he is almost certain to do if we continue along the present course, the safety of American troops in the region, our friends, our allies alike, and also in other countries that have in the area are going to be affected by this.
Are you proposing
and then,
that...
But wait, let me
just ask a quick question.
One other point.
Let me ask you a quick question to follow up, and that is, are you suggesting that the biological weapons sites themselves should be blown up?
In this case, I think it is important that we target those. That is correct.
Isn't there a concern about what this would mean if these kind of chemicals are released into the atmosphere?
Well, there is, but there are also ways of dealing with that. But let me go on. What's very important, and you raise a very important point in this case, Saddam Hussein has already used these chemical weapons. There already has been concern about their release in the atmosphere. During the Iran-Iraq war, Saddam Hussein did not desist in going ahead and using them against the Iranian people. Also, he has used them against his own people. You just had a discussion about the plight of the Kurds. The Kurds were attacked and used, chemical weapons were used on them. The point is here, I couldn't agree more with Gordon about the concern about the risk of lives. Preventive action in this case, I think, is warranted, because the circumstances and history has shown that what we have dealt with here is someone and a regime who has not stopped at any cost or any effort, certainly not with diplomacy, to use these biological and chemical weapons if necessary.
Gordon Clark, I want to get your response, but first I wanted to play the response of Norman Schwarzkopf, the general leading commander during the Gulf War,
sure,
who was questioned by Tim Russert on Meet the Press this weekend about innocent civilians.
Let me comment on the innocent civilians. You know, an awful lot of the innocent civilians in the past, quite frankly, have been due to them, to the Iraqis' firepower, where we send our airstrikes in, they throw everything up in the air, it comes back down and lands on their own people and hurts them. It's true, there are going to be innocent civilians hurt. We're going to do everything we can, I know, to avoid civilian casualties, to avoid civilian areas. But civilians are going to get hurt both by us, but also a great deal of civilians, a large number of civilians are going to be hurt by their own ordnance.
We dropped 88,000 tons of bombs on Iraq during the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein's still there, thumbing his nose at us. Will this change his behavior?
No, I don't think it'll change his behavior at all. I mean, his only interest is his place in history. He wants to be the second coming of Nebuchadnezzar. I think that he is perfectly willing to risk the lives of many, many thousands of people in his own country.
That was Norman Schwarzkopf speaking on Meet the Press. Gordon Clark, an unusual response on the issue of how innocent civilians will die, that if the U.S. Tries to strike them with air attacks, that if Saddam Hussein tries to head off those attacks and then hits their missiles, I guess, with his own, it'll be his fault if the rubble that, you know, the stuff that falls from the sky falls on his own people.
Well, a couple responses. It's interesting. I'm not sure whether to call it alligator tears or not about the loss of innocent lives. It seems that those people who are supporting military action are happy to keep saying that, you know, it's Saddam Hussein who's risking these lives, but then we're perfectly happy to oblige him by going and participating in a campaign which we know for sure will kill them. I would also add that when you're doing massive sustained aerial bombardment, there is no way to prevent massive civilian casualties. There are no high-technology smart bombs that can tell the difference between a Republican Guard member and a civilian. So people need to go into this knowing that we're going to kill a lot of people, a lot of innocent people. And frankly, I think that's one of the reasons that you don't hear that talked about by Clinton or Madeleine Albright. It's amazing to me, by the way, that, you know, being in Washington these days when everyone's talking about the morality of whether or not President Clinton might have had an affair with an intern, that the morality of killing thousands of innocent people doesn't seem to figure into the moral calculus of Madeleine Albright or President Clinton or the press corps at large. So we have to know we're killing lots of people. And I think if the American people had that repeated to them, I think if they started seeing some pictures of what we actually did in 1991 and what would happen again, I think you'd see a significant lessening of support for this campaign. The other thing I want to talk about is what history has shown about Saddam Hussein. And actually, I think Paula Dobransky is probably in a good position to know, having served on the NSC with the Reagan Department, Reagan administration, I should say. And that is the fact that in the past, Saddam Hussein has only done what he could get away with, and in fact has done it with the blessing of the United States. We will recall that we supported Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran. We provided him with money. We provided him with dual-use technology. We provided him with military information. We should remember that the United States looked the other way when we had positive proof that Saddam Hussein was using his chemical weapons on his own people. In fact, it was George Bush himself who cast a vote in the Senate about continuing aid to Iraq even after we knew that he was using chemical weapons on his own people. And even in the case of the invasion of Kuwait, we all know about the situation with the State Department attaché, April Glaspie, who's over there, telling Saddam Hussein the United States has no interest in your border issues with Kuwait. So clearly, history tells us that Saddam Hussein will do what he thinks he can get away with. We're in a completely different situation now. Saddam Hussein is politically isolated, militarily contained, more so than any other dictator in history. We have a historic chance to find a different way to deal with these type of problems, but in fact, the United States seems, again, hell-bent on in provoking a fight. And you know, frankly, whether you think Saddam Hussein is a rational but evil man, or whether you think he's insane and a crazed dog, dropping bombs on him and aiming for his overthrow is only going to make him to resort to any means he has available. And perhaps if, chemical weapons drop on Israel as a result of our bombing, then we might think twice about whether it was a good idea to go in there and start this.
I'd like to ask about another issue that I haven't heard addressed very much in many of the national news talk shows, which is the impact of any possible escalation of this conflict in the rest of the Arab world. Clearly, countries like Egypt, Turkey, have serious internal problems with fundamentalism and growth of anti-American movements within their own countries. Would this kind of a escalation of the conflict or massive bombing create possible repercussions in terms of civil strife within major and important Arab countries in the region? I'd like to ask that to Paula Dobransky first and then Gordon Clark.
Sure.
I think that no one wants violence. The region has been strife with conflict of all sorts. And in this case, I think it is fair to say that, and you asked me this at the outset about the coalition, I think it's fair to say that a coalition that was struck earlier when there was outright aggression and the lives of the Kuwaiti people were slaughtered, innocent lives. Those types of pictures, I think, resounded with many Americans, and I'm sure that the continual violence that we have witnessed in that region resounds with many across the world. In this case, I think that the United States, in going ahead with military action in this case, I think what you will see is not a provocation or where you will see demonstrations or an outbreak of that sort. I think you're basically going to see more of a neutral position. Many of the Arab countries have not looked favorably upon Iraq, basically because of the aggressive actions which have been taken and the lack of any kind of constructive behavior and any type of diplomacy in the region.
Gordon Clark?
There will be demonstrations. You can all come to one tomorrow in front of the White House at 12 noon, for starters. I think there is someone here who wants violence. I think it's the Clinton administration that wants violence to talk about all diplomatic initiatives being used. And by the way, I'm not here to suggest that there's any easy or quick answer to this problem. I don't think it is. And I think that's one of the problems with turning to massive bombardment is the idea, oh, well, this will be an easy fix. This will take care of the problem, when in fact it won't. But I find it ironic that, in fact, fact, the chief diplomat of the United States, Madeleine Albright, for the past month has been globetrotting, saying diplomacy isn't going to work. Diplomacy isn't going to work. We've got to drop bombs. We've got to drop bombs. That doesn't sound to me like an administration that's trying to avoid violence. It sounds to me like an administration that wants violence. In terms of the repercussions, you know, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Jordan, the reason that they are not supporting this action, the reason that they do not want U.S. airplanes, Turkey, I might add, do not want U.S. airplanes functioning, attack aircraft functioning from their airfields, is not because they are peace-loving countries. It's because they understand that their own populations are feeling increasingly resentful of the United States, which bombards Arab populations at will and without repercussions. That is why they don't want U.S. strike planes flying from their soil. And I would repeat again that this is going to have potentially disastrous consequences on an already faltering Middle East peace process. What can it possibly mean? What are the people in the White House thinking, if anything at all, will be the effect of the primary military and political sponsor of the State of Israel, which so desperately needs peace in the region, once again, for the second time in 7 years, going in and dropping huge numbers of bombs on an Arab population? Can they possibly think that this is going to have anything but negative effects on the peace process? Just to name one example. So, yes, in fact, there are going to be repercussions among the Arab peoples of the world, and that is why Arab governments are not supporting this ill-thought-out, strategically perilous, morally bankrupt concept of ours.
On that note, Gordon Clark and Paula Dobryansky, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Gordon Clark, if people want to find out where protests are happening around the country tomorrow, I know there are another set of them that will be happening on Thursday, but the peace action ones that are being coordinated for tomorrow, where can they call?
People can call Peace Action at 1-800-228-1228. That's 1-800-228-1228. And again, there will be one in Washington on Wednesday at noon, tomorrow Wednesday, in front of the White House.
Well, we want to thank you, Gordon Clark, Executive Director of Peace Action, and Paula Dobryansky, Head of the Washington Office of the Council on Foreign Relations, for joining us. And, of course, we'll continue to follow developments around the world, around Iraq. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute.
I'll come together. I'll come together.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In just a minute, we're going to find out about one of the longest strikes in the nation's history, ending just about a week ago. But before we do that, Juan, I wanted to ask you about your interview with John Sweeney just last week. John Sweeney had just returned from Davos, also Mexico, Davos in Switzerland, where he was attending the World Economic Summit. What was that?
Yes, well, for those of our listeners who don't know, John Sweeney is the head of the AFL-CIO, the top labor leader in the country. And amazingly, he was attending the World Economic Conference, which is probably the biggest gathering of corporate CEOs and government leaders who are involved with the economic branches of their government or finance policy in the world. And he was attending for the second time. He had attended the previous year. He was one of only six labor leaders throughout the world who was invited to participate. Sweeney took the opportunity to deliver a presentation where he talked about the increasing dangers of globalization in terms of the living standards of workers around the world, especially the crises, for instance, in Asia. And I think that as a whole, the New York Times had an article reporting how all the corporate leaders were anxious to sit down with Sweeney, understanding that there was some kind of a resurgence going on in the American labor movement. But the fact that he went there to deliver this message to the leaders of international business is unusual, to say the least, for a labor leader. But supposedly now there will be more labor leaders invited in the future, the organizers of the World Economic Conference say. And Sweeney, I think, my interview with him dealt with overall issues that were occurring in the labor movement and everything from the crisis in the Teamsters to the future of the political relationship of the AFL-CIO to the Democratic and Republican parties and free trade. And I published one column on it last week in the Daily News, and it'll be part of a forthcoming book on the labor movement that Joanne Mort of Unite is putting out.
That's the New York Daily News.
Right. But interestingly enough, I think that Sweeney clearly, in the short time that he's been head of the AFL-CIO, has sparked a renaissance in organizing. More and more unions are devoting more of their resources to bringing in new members. He's sparked a new direction in terms of bringing in immigrant workers and women at all levels of the union movement, and has begun to spur a new direction in terms of greater democracy in the union movement. So I think he's been a surprise to many people who felt that he'd come out of the old guard, and even though he had led a palace revolt against Lane Kirkland and Tom Donohue, the old members, that he has actually turned out to be much more open to progressive forces within the labor movement, changing the old business unionism way of operation of America's organized labor.
But he does have to deal with the scandal that has taken place both in the Democratic Party that has gotten a part of the Teamsters involved with that. I mean, this at the same time now that the Senate campaign finance hearings are wrapping up, the Senate Republicans and Democrats putting out two separate reports. But what does he see? Elections are coming up again, actually, midterm elections, and then the elections of the 2000. What will be the role of labor? Last time, I think it was something like $35 million they put into races.
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is there's a much more emphasis in terms of using the mass media to educate the population in general. For instance, the AFL sponsored an experimental program in one section in several cities in the United States where they did saturation television advertising, generic advertising about the importance of unions. And then they did polling before and after the ad campaign. And they found, for instance, that the level of support of non-union people for unions increased substantially after the ad campaign. Shows you how much Americans are conditioned by television, that even if you put out ads about what unions have done, they suddenly begin to think better about unions. So that I think he's going in that direction, using more modern vehicles of mass communications to put forth the message of the labor movement in general, as well as recruiting all these young kids who are coming out of the colleges and young workers to become full-time organizers, because the labor movement, in order to even keep abreast of its current population, has to increase about 400,000 new members a year and to and have a 3% increase in growth, which is what the AFL-CIO set as a target, basically have to organize 800,000 new members every year.
Well, it's very instructive that the ads for unions actually change people's opinions. If you look at how television is working around the war and the possible bombing of Saddam Hussein, these large ads that are the network news shows and the talk shows clearly are manufacturing consent for war as well. Well, sticking with the issue of unions, on February 1st, the longest strike in the nation for four decades ended at the stroke of midnight. 550 workers at the Frontier Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, maids, cocktail waitresses, bartenders, and cooks walked off the job 6.5 years ago to protest the resort's treatment of its employees. The strike ended a week ago. We're joined by Glenn Arnotto, who is the political coordinator of the Culinary Workers Union Local 226 in Las Vegas. Welcome to Democracy Now!
morning.
Well, tell us about the significance of this victory, what the strike was about, and what this means for labor in this country.
Well, almost 7 years ago, as you said, 550 workers walked off the job at the Frontier. And this walkout was in response to massive violations of law by their employer, including, and most significantly, the termination of the employee's pension plan. So it really never was about wages or benefits. It was about this employer's intent to destroy the union. And that's really the thing that kept those workers going. I don't think you could have a struggle of this magnitude over money or benefits. They really saw that it was the future of their union, and they weren't about to let an employer destroy that.
Now, according to the reports, throughout the 6.5 years of the strike, not a single worker crossed the picket line. Could you tell us a little bit about how that kind of unity was built up and what that meant to the overall union drive that the AFL-CIO had targeted for Las Vegas?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I've been in the labor movement more than 20 years, and at least in the time I've been in the labor movement, I've never witnessed anything like that in the 6.5 years. Now, one of the workers crossed the picket line to go back. At the end of the strike, we still had about 250 of the original 550 workers picketing full-time, meaning 30 hours a week. Picket line stayed up 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You know, it's just a remarkable testimony to the will and the strength of working people. The strike really did play a role in the success of our union's organizing. We've doubled in size. Our local is now 40,000 members. I think we're the fastest growing private sector local union in the country. And though that strike took a tremendous human toll on people, it did serve as a living reminder to virtually every employer in Las Vegas that our union had the ability to fight. And if you took us on, we would mount a fight and never give up until we won. So it really did aid the organizing. And even though, you know, it's hard for people to imagine that you could even organize workers while you have a strike going on that's lasted almost 7 years, but it did play that role, though it took, as I said, a tremendous toll on the strikers.
The Las Vegas unionizing efforts, Las Vegas overall has been called the Gettysburg of the union movement. Can you explain why? I don't think a lot of people realize the significance of Las Vegas.
Well, I think there's probably more organizing going on in Las Vegas per capita than any city in the United States. And that was largely paved by what the Culinary Workers Union has done in the hotel casino industry. For one thing, we have a booming industry. But that alone is not responsible for growth of the union. One of the things that we decided to do in the rebuilding of this local union starting in 1987 was that we knew that we had to make organizing the central job of the union, or the union would not continue to exist. We had new hotel casinos that were being planned. We knew the boom was coming in the industry. If the union didn't keep pace, we would basically go out of existence. So we made organizing a priority, and what that meant with the membership was really educating the membership to understand that it didn't do us any good to win 25 cents or 50 cents an hour if a non-union casino opened across the street, because ultimately that would threaten to drag us all down. So really the center point of our efforts with our own membership in building a good, strong shop steward system and internal organization centered around organizing and getting the members to see that we had to make that a priority. We did that. It was our central contract demand back in 1989 that any casino, any employer that we had under contract, if they built a new casino, they had to take a neutral stance toward the union. And they had to agree that if we signed up a majority of workers, that they would recognize the union and negotiate a contract. And that was our central contractual demand as opposed to money, benefits, or anything else. We were successful, and that's resulted in the tremendous growth of this union over the last 10 years.
Well, it's been said that Las Vegas is the fastest growing city in the country. And obviously, because of the nature of the hotel and gaming industry, you're in a position as a private sector union that you don't have as much fear about the employers fleeing to Asia or to Mexico because they're there to make money off the gamblers that are right there in the United States. But I'd like to ask you, one of the unusual things about this strike is the level of support that the union got from other hotel and casino owners who apparently felt thoroughly embarrassed by the reactionary nature of these particular owners. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, in fact, that support occurred in a number of ways, but the most dramatic of which, William Bennett, who used to be the CEO of Circus Enterprises, one of the largest gaming companies, and now has his own company called Sahara Gaming. For 6 of the 7 years, he provided a food truck and cooks, and he himself, out of his own pocket, it probably cost him $1 million, fed the strikers 3 times a day. Here he's one of the richest men in the United States, and at the beginning of the strike, he made a statement saying that if he were a worker, he'd be out there carrying a picket sign because he felt what was being done to those strikers was wrong, and he wanted to support them. And that single act, that food truck, meant more to the strikers than I think any other thing that was done to help them. It was a sign that somebody cared. They knew they could count on it. It came out there, as I said, 3 times a day, and it really meant a lot.
The Culinary Workers Union Local 226 is affiliated with the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union here, I guess it's called. You also had what the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, involved, the Teamsters?
Oh, virtually every. Well, on strike with us, we had, there were a total of 5 unions. There was our sister union, the bartenders, the operating engineers, Teamsters, and carpenters. And all unions stayed out together, and all unions went back together.
I understand also throughout the strike there were major marches and protests by tens of thousands of people marching through downtown Las Vegas. How were you able to build up that kind of energy, which has been sorely missing in many other cities and labor conflicts throughout the country?
Well, you know, we are fortunate. Las Vegas really is a union town, and maybe unfortunately, it's, I think, one of the last union towns in America, and that's something we have to change. But there really is a high degree of union consciousness here, not just in the casino industry, but in construction, supermarkets, et cetera. And, it always was about keeping Las Vegas a union town and keeping a standard of living that really is unique, we think, in the United States. I mean, there aren't many places where a hotel maid, for example, might be able to own her own home or send her kids to college. And people were not about to let any one owner or person or company take that away. They understood that if it happened at the frontier, there would be some other employer would get the idea they could do the same thing. Getting back, however, to an earlier point you made about you can't move hotels to Mexico and maybe there's less fear. That part is true. However, we have had employers here in organizing drives who, and we have one now, who, while they can't get up and move, they do just about anything that they can to avoid the unionization of their workers. We have an organizing drive going on now in the food service departments of a casino where it's a unit of about 800, and we've already had 20 people on the organizing committee fired. So even in Las Vegas, workers face extreme repression in many cases if they decide to organize.
Well, Glenn Arnotto, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us, political coordinator of the Culinary Workers Union, part of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union. They have won the longest strike in the nation in 40 years. 550 workers march back into work on February 1st. Congratulations. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. We're really interested in people who are organizing around the possible Persian Gulf attack. If you have an event happening, please fax us the information at 212-564-5359. That's 212-564-5359. or let us know on our phone at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. Or you can email us at democracy@pacifica.org. We will keep a peace watch here on Democracy Now!, democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee Soo Koo, Errol Maitland, our engineer in New York, Joe Gill, our engineer in Washington. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez in the studios of Pacifica Station WBAI. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!